side, and he will give us a nice integrated central autonomic and cardiac spectrum.
Thank you. I would like to spend the first perhaps 10 or so minutes to motivate the research problem and also mainly to introduce the technical issues we were facing. And then I will spend the next 20 or so minutes to explain the new method that we introduced in the, developed in the past years to solve these particular issues that we believe hasn't been discussed or addressed before. Finally, we will go back to the problem and then show some of the results from our analysis. So the our interest is really, again, related to heart rate variability, and we're motivated by the phenomenon itself. And in particular, we're very interested in a multifractal phenomenon. What it means is that there is a certain type of fluctuation pattern. You actually could extract certain structures. The interesting part will be introduced later, but let me just begin to introduce some what people normally call the stylized facts about HRV. In particular, we're looking at the R2R or the beat-to-beat time sequence, and that's what we normally call the R interval. And this is one particular sample taken from a young adult. I think this is the first year master's student from our department, and a healthy young male, and in a supine lying on the tilt table. So basically, you see the typical fluctuation over a wide range. The first thing about this stylized fact is the in 1982, Kobayashi and Musha perhaps were the first to at least report the property about this so-called one over F noise. That is, if you take the R interval and then you take the power spectral density, you plot the result in the log-log scale, you get this 1 over F pattern showing up. In this particular case, you see a little peak here. That's typically the so-called RSA, which is related to the cardiovascular and respiratory coupling. So this is the first thing that we like to mention. The second part of it is what we realize is the if you start to look into more detail regarding this R interval and how it fluctuates, we start to consider what we call the R increments. That is, you take the R interval at certain heartbeat, N representing the number of beats, and then you look at what happened to the R interval 8 heartbeats later. In that fashion, you begin to have this another sequence. We call it the increment. The increment typically is a function of at which particular heartbeat you're looking at, and also at the extent of time or the heartbeats you look into the future. And for our interval, for the human HRV, typically you see this kind of pattern. That is, if you look at very near-term changes in our interval, the distribution of this difference, or we call the increment, exhibits some kind of a non-Gaussian behavior. In fact, it is what we also call the large scale skirt type of behavior, or stretch exponential. That is, it's not entirely exponential, but you will find the tail part of it actually get spread out. Notice that this is actually plotted. I didn't do the correction here. This should be in the log scale here. And if you start to look at the increment of our interval starting from this instant to a far future, as say A become very large, then it's typically uncorrelated, almost like a Gaussian type of noise, and you get this Gaussian behavior. So overall, you will find there is a change from the stretch exponential type of distribution in our increment all the way to Gaussian increment once you look into a larger scale. This particular property actually exists very widely in other other physical system, from financial data to equity pricing, also going to the fluid turbulence, and also social networking. So there are lots of physical system with complicated complicated behavior does show this kind of increment property. And this particular situation is necessary condition for something called the multifractal characteristics. And that was first reported by the Boston group. That is actually, they have very close collaboration with Eric Goldberger and lots of physicists look into this particular property simply because it's widespread appearance in other physical systems. So in 1999, they were the first group who reported multifractal property in HRV. This is entirely a time domain assessment. That is basically to try to understand how the fluctuation, try to quantify exactly how the fluctuation is going to be. And the underlying idea is very intuitive. Basically, you try to look at, you introduce a scale variable, and you try to see how much fluctuation there is. And we're going to get into more about this this formulation later. In the end, what's going to happen is you typically get this kind of a parabolic curve plotted as a function, we call it f of h versus the h, where h really is trying to characterize how dramatic that increase is going to be. And the way we read this curve is really to look at this particular range of h value, which attain a very large f of h value, which means how typical you're going to run into the kind of fluctuation you're trying to characterize. So all of this is going to be explained in more detail later. So these are the three major characteristics or the so-called stylized fact about our interval, at least in healthy human. So there are some physiological understanding about this HRV as well as its fractal property. For example, Axelrod, the famous paper, and then also in 1996, there is a major collaboration from different cardiology society from Europe and North America. They published a paper, we call it the task force document, that really outlined all the basic understanding at that time. Even today, lots of this, the results reported in the task force document still consider the gold standard. And in this article, you're going to find lots of idea regarding the autonomic control that influence the heart rate variability. Perhaps the most practical part of it is related to how they associate with the autonomic nervous system, the parasympathetic and sympathetic characteristics, and how those property can be reviewed from the fluctuation from our intervals, specifically in the low and high frequency range. And significant interest really come from some of the other studies that shows how heart disease patients have this reduced HRV. Not necessarily about those fractal property, but in general, there is a reduce in various so-called variability measures. They typically exist in the heart disease patient. And physicists get very excited. They try to extend this to cover everything, saying that most system which begin to deteriorate will eventually exhibit this kind of reduced variability phenomenon. So this quickly can push you into the philosophical ground to talk about how everything works together. So, but at least in the clinical setting, this has raised lots of interest, trying to tie in the reduction of HRV and the heart conditions. In our case, what we're really interested in is to try to figure out the reasons, because assuming you and I have a healthy cardiovascular operation, then we should have quite a bit of variability in our heart rate, but how come it disappear in the disease patients? So the obvious question will be, what's the origin of it? Is there an anatomical sort of regions you can identify, or is it entirely a functional features from which, what is the function? Why does the system has to evolve in such a manner? So there are various proposals and suggestions. For our case, we're really interested in what may happen from the central nervous system, because it's hard to imagine it had nothing to do with it. In fact, there are lots of evidence cardiovascular functions and central system are coupled. For example, several study, these are just a very short summary of what a large volume of such studies. So there are lots of studies showing this kind of coupling. For example, the onset of exercise, your heart rate will immediately start to increase, even your body doesn't move 1 inch. It's just some sort of anticipation. And also fears in intense situation, the autonomic system quickly respond to what your thought process is. And in particular for the HRV, there are studies about sleep, mental exercise, and onset of exercise. All of these studies shows in various conditions, you can in fact influence the fractal property of HRV. For example, this particular paper by Bundy, they looked at various sleep stages and used the so-called Dutrant fluctuation analysis to show how fractal exponent changes from slow wave sleep all the way to REM sleep. And lots of them are quite similar. Basically, you can see dramatic difference once the mental state starts changing. So based on those premise, we have the central hypothesis, and we try to formulate our inquiry in the most modest way. We try to hypothesize that the central nervous system could have some influence directly to the multifractal characteristics of HRV. And our question then become, just as the first step, not to try too ambitiously, we try to understand how to relate the fluctuation in brain activity to the multifractal HRV. The initial intent was really just to compare scaling exponents, but after some reading we realized it is in fact quite ambiguous. And step by step it led us to develop a new method, which is really the main subject I'm going to cover for the next 20 minutes. And I deem this is necessary to go through some of the basics so we can really appreciate why we are doing this new methodology I'm going to introduce to you. So, but before that, let me explain the experiment we had in mind. Basically, we tried to perturb the autonomic system by doing head-up tilt, passive head-up tilt. So we have subject lying supine, and then upright, the angle we tilt is 70 degrees. And so from the literature, we know that there is an increase in sympathetic nervous system activity once the subject is tilted up, and there's a decrease in parasympathetic nervous system activities. And the R interval, as a result, going to go to a lower level and will reduce the amount of the degree of variation. It could be explained just by the neurotransmitter ACH, which is the primary transmitter for PNS, parasympathetic system, act very quickly compared to the sympathetic system. So once this sympathetic activity become heightened, you would expect things getting a little bit sluggish, not fast moving. So our interest would be to also measure the EEG data from the surface scale potential variation, and we try to understand the kind of fluctuation we see here. Would there be any sign that there may become somehow related or similar? And also, in order to relate to some of the literature results, we also try to get frequency band characteristics to try to relate to some of those multifractal property we find from the HRV. So basically, we know all of these has contribution to the multifractal HRV property. Our main objective is to try to understand how all of these from the EEG side contribute to it. So that's what I'm trying to do for the next maybe 15-20 minutes. That is, I want to go over some very basic idea about fractal time series analysis, and we want to show you the extension that we made, which allows us to examine this, the question we just posted. Basically, the idea to try to understand the fractal time series is really to have some assessment about how dramatic it fluctuates. Luckily, the machinery is already there in the mathematics literature, and that is something called a Hodder continuity. So if we assume we have an x of t, typically what we're trying to find is to find a polynomial so that the difference between x of t and the polynomial based on certain time instant t0 will behave according to this kind of power law behavior. And if you were to replace this by the Taylor expansion, then everything makes sense. It's just go back to the elementary understanding from the functions. But in general, this doesn't have to follow the standard setting for the Taylor and the Taylor expansion. So this H star, which is how the difference between x of t and a polynomial in a local neighborhood could really reveal some characteristics about the fluctuations. But if you want to be a little bit more rigorous, there is actually a range of H star value that could make this happen. And to be definite, we will always call the subnorm, that is the largest exponent that could make this happen, to be the Hodder exponent. And sometimes this is also called a singularity strength at t0. And there are some easy interpretation about this h parameter or the exponent. If h lies in the range between n and n plus 1, then you can easily show that this x of t is n time differentiable, but not n plus 1 times. And so basically the h exponent provides some sort of a measurement as to how smooth the function is locally, okay? And so that's the starting point of doing this kind of calculation. And to estimate a Hodder exponent, there has been lots of attempts, mainly in the 80s. I think if I remember correctly, mostly the people who's doing this was really coming from the turbulence community. Fluid turbulence has been the major driving force in pushing these boundaries further and further. At that time, this was considered the main machinery that allows us to understand fluctuation in fluid flow. And there has been lots of work trying to figure out what's the most accurate way to find this scaling exponent. It wasn't until Mallet and Huang, which is an article published in 1992, that pointed out that there is actually a connection between wavelet transform and those dramatic fluctuation in the time series. Then Muzi, Bakri, and Aniado eventually provides us a more systematic way to estimate those exponents numerically. So this is a standard form about wavelet transform, and what happened is we will first, based on the wavelet transform of the time series, we will form something called a partition function. And that analogy really is made based on exact similar sets of formulation existed in statistical physics, where a partition function is one scalar function that allows you to derive entropy, enthalpy, and all different kind of thermodynamic quantities. So that's really where what the terminology came from. And if we take the wavelet coefficients and raise it to the power q, and then we will try to find those wavelet coefficients not everywhere in the wave timescale plane, but along those particular geometrical structure we call the wavelet maxima lines, then this is proven the most accurate and reliable ways to estimate the Hodder exponents. And in recent years, there are other methods that came out actually challenge how reliable this method is. But still, many study could confirm with you that this is still one of the best approach out there to estimate the wavelet coefficients. So let me, I'm sorry, to estimate the Holder exponents. Let me give you a precise example what all this means. So forget about this first. Let's just look, start from here. This is exactly the same formula I showed in the previous slide. And this is just a wavelet coefficient along the maximum line. I raised to the Q power. And then what this formulation shows is that eventually this function, scalar function, will behave according as a power law according to the scale you use and the and raised to a certain exponent we call the tau of Q. So if you take this R interval we showed previously, you do the wavelet transform on the time scale plane, you can imagine the wavelet transform coefficient is a scalar function of two parameters. One is the time, the other one is the scale. So you can imagine if you look down from the time scale plane, you could see it's basically a surface lying on top of the time scale plane, but this surface actually has mountain and valley. If you connect all the line, all the points along the mountaintop, you're going to find those what we call the maximal lines. That means If you look at this particular location for a particular T and A value, the coefficient at that particular point would be the local maximum. And they all form this line. The main result coming from those previous study was, in particular, the discovery by Mallette and Huang, was that whenever the time series exhibits dramatic fluctuations, and that is exactly when those maximum line going to emerge. It's going to emerge mostly at the location where you have those dramatic fluctuations. So if I take the time, this particular R interval, do the wavelet transform, I get those wavelet coefficients and then try to match out the maximum lines. This is one particular profile. If I were to look at the wavelet coefficient along this red line at the scale A star, this is what they look like. This is the modulus of it. So I identify all the local maxima, and these local maxima map out the location where those line passes, okay? And once you have those lines figured out, you just pull out the coefficient along those lines, plug it in this so-called partition function, you'll be able to construct your Z function. And then we will plot them in the log-log scale to figure out these particular coefficients. For this real data, this is what happened. The log of Z and log of A plot shows you quite convincingly there are some linear range which indicates this power law behavior. And there are some calculations after this point which will allow you to do this, show you this parabolic sort of curve which we call the F of H curve. And the idea of this F of H curve really comes from this line that I like to draw your attention to. That is, we assume the time interval in which the time series exhibits certain type of fluctuation has a dimension of F of H. So when you see this peak somewhere around here, that's probably H equals 0.2. That would be the most typical fluctuation you're going to find in this time series. And this is a statistical measure. It doesn't really tell you exactly when you're going to find it, but if you were to randomly pick lots of time instants, most likely you'll find the R interval going to fluctuate according to this particular H value that we use to characterize it. And this is the calculation that allows you to find the F of H. So first of all, once we find the tau function from this log-log plot, we will then try to differentiate it, and this is when it's come to numerical analysis, it's really just finite difference. Find the delta tau divided by delta q that we use. That gives us an estimate of h, and then the f of h will be carried out by this calculation q times h minus the tau q. There's another interpretation that would tell you the probability of finding a particular h value in your time series is given by A to the 1 minus F of that F function. So there are many different interpretations, all points to the one one idea that this FFH really characterizes exactly how often the kind of fluctuation you're going to find in the time series. And I wonder, at this point, I want to introduce an equivalent formulation, because this is exactly where we made the extension. The equivalent formulation would be, if you go back to previously, we say the Z is a function, Z will behave according to a power law of A to the tau Q. And that Z is calculated based on the modulus maxima from the wavelet transform. And I will just simply put this to this side into the sum. And this tells us, if I could find my wavelet transform raised to some Q power, multiply another function. This function has a power law behavior. If I could find this particular exponent so that the product of these two sum together over all maximum lines, that it doesn't really vary according to the length scale A, then this tau function has a specific meaning according to the above. So that's the starting point of our extension, which I'm going to elaborate more later. So before we do that, I have to introduce one more development after this point, which is Manuver and Srinivasan. They are from the Yale University, and these are fluid dynamists. They study specifically fluid turbulence and its multifractal characteristics. They introduced in 1990 what they call the joint partition function analysis. That is, the reason they want to consider that, because in fluid analysis, they want to look at velocity fluctuation as well as temperature fluctuation. And they want to see if it's connected in any way, have a connection. So it's a natural, very natural extension. So you're now facing two time series. One, you can imagine X represents the velocity in the fluid flow. Y represents the temperature or other thermodynamic property in the fluid flow. And they try to find what kind of characteristics they have once they put them together as a simple extension from the single time series. And again, they find empirically there is a power law to characterize this kind of product term summing up together. Now here, you have to match those maximum lines. That's the technical part of this. You have to figure out what are the closest maximum lines that you can find so that you can pull out the corresponding wavelet coefficients. And just follow exactly the same formulation, you'll be able to do a similar type of derivation to get the Hodder exponent for the first time series, second time series. And also, what's most importantly is this particular function, F function, which is an extension from the single time series. Now we're going to have this F depend on two scaling exponents. And that would characterize the dimension of a two-dimensional domain in which the X and Y are characterized by the singularity strength, HX and HY. So that's the partition function analysis. So let's look at an example. So if we were to consider a binomial cascade, the so-called binomial cascade is constructed as follows. You pick two arbitrary numbers, they sum up to be one. And then at first, you try to separate, you have one interval, you separate it into two intervals, and so on and so forth. Every time, you just separate the domain into two pieces, and you assign a value to each of those pieces. After you do this many, many times, you will have this entire interval to be very, very finely partitioned. And then for all those M1, M2 that you assign in those little intervals, you in the end multiply them all together. That kind of construction would eventually give you a multifractal function. So what we're trying to do here is that we come up with, we try to build one cascade, we call it mu, the other cascade we call it pi, and then mu is constructed by using two number m1 m2. In the example, I'm going to show you m1 equals 0.1, 0.2 and 0.8, and m2 equals 0.8. And the other cascade, following exactly the same construction, will be built by using two exactly similar, but using two different numbers. In the example I show you, P1, P2 equals 0.4 and 0.6. And but we have a little twist in doing this. That is, we try to couple the two time series together. The way we coupled it is, every time we pick an M1, M2 for the mu cascade, we're going to flip a coin. If the coin turns out, going to give me a random number. If that random number is less than a preset value G, G going to be a number between 0 and 1, then I'm going to couple the two cascades. But I'm not going to couple it directly. I'm just going to make sure that every time I assign M1 to the left interval, I will also assign P1 to the left interval. So there's a matching in terms of how the order of those weights going to be applied to the intervals, which indirectly going to determine how what kind of fluctuations the mu and pi time series going to have. But if the coin, once you flip a coin, the value is bigger than the G value you set previously, preset value G, then the second cascade pi, I will not make any attempt to relate this assignment process. So what does it all mean? This is what happened when I said G equal to 0. What G equal to 0 means is every time I flip a coin, if gamma is less than 0, now gamma is a uniform random variable in 0 to 1, so it could never happen. That means every time we go through this arrow to build the second cascade, and they are totally independent from each other. The other case I'm going to show you in that picture is when G equals 1. G equals 1, since gamma is a uniform random variable 0, 1, so any time you flip a coin, it's always less than 1. That means they will always be coupled in terms of their assignment, those how the weights are assigned to the intervals. So if you do this and try to build a time series, you will find this time series and this one corresponding to G0, they are totally independent. Perhaps it's not obvious from first sight, but if you try to see where the pick emerges, okay, they don't really seem to following any particular order or sequence. And this is the case G equals 1. That means the two time series are totally coupled to each other in terms of those weight assignment. And again, if you check where the pick emerge, you find they all emerge at the same time. Even the in terms of the magnitude, there's probably no not much correlation at all. It's, oh, this is the X. So this at this location, that 0 over here is 1. And Y is simply the value of those functions. Let me just perhaps repeat again. I have a 0, 1 interval. I split it in half. And then I assign the value to each of the interval. And then I continue that process to smaller, smaller, smaller intervals. So every small interval in the end has a number associated with it. And then in the end, I multiply them all together. So that's going to generate this kind of time series. And of course, you can have other variations. But the point is, if you introduce this kind of coupling mechanism, you are able to construct time series that going to have those fluctuation occurs at the same time. Okay? So if you do so, you can take each of those time series and do the wavelet transform, go through the maximum lines and so on, you find when G equals 1, when they are all totally coupled to each other, the maximum lines all emerge at the same location. The X axis here is the time, Y axis is the scale plotted in the log scale, and this is basically the time scale plane. When you reduce, lower the G values all the way to 0, you find those lines are emerge at different instants almost randomly. In this plot, the blue dots represent the maximum line from the mu cascade. The red dots represent the maximum line of the pi cascade. So in this way, we are able to at least construct some artificial scenarios that allows us to see how those fluctuations happen at which instant, and then try to see what this joint partition function, in particular, how those fluctuation the fluctuation can be characterized. So again, we try to just do the finite difference to figure out the tau QP, except that this time we have to map out the entire two-dimensional domain. We have to go through a range of Q and range of P, and then we're going to find the h of x and h sub y. Again, these are a function of Q and P. In the end, we are able to do this to figure out the f of hx and hy. So typically, it's going to give you a dome shape. This is h of mu and h of pi. And then this is all the cases we've shown earlier. For g equals 1, you find this entire dome collapse into one sheet. And if you look from the top, they just become a line. As you reduce the g value to the case where they are totally independent from each other, then you can see the dome expand to the maximum domain. Typically, the interpretation of this is whenever one time series fluctuates at certain strength, you will find exactly the same, there is a unique correspondence between the fluctuation of this time series, the singularity strength of one time series to the other. But once the two time series are not coupled to each other, they all fluctuate as well, they all fluctuate, but they have no connection at all, then you will find that for any particular fluctuation strength you find from one time series, there could be a range of fluctuation strength coming from the second time series. The strength of fluctuation, I can quickly go back to show you exactly what it means. And that is actually shown over here. Basically, when I have a time series, I try to see if I were to increase a little from one sample to the next, I want to see how much variation happens in the y-axis. So this is very intuitive, just like you try to find what is the derivative of a time of a function, or trying to assess how continuous the time series is. If this delta r changes so dramatically, what happens is this h value is going to be very, very small. Because what happens is when a is very small, we're looking at infinitesimal change of a function value. Now, this function could be r interval, could be respiration time series, could be anything you're looking at. I'm looking at how infinitesimal change in the x, and then see how dramatic the change in the y. So that's really the starting. Dramatic change is when h is less than 1. Because in those cases, the time series is actually not, you're not able to really consider that as even being continuous. It's basically just consists of lots of jump. Okay, and of course, this is all assessed in a numerical sense. There's no way you can ever be, you know, there's no way you can ever be certain about whether this is a continuous function or differentiable function from a sample data. So it's all about this h value in the end. Imagine a is very small. If the time series is very smooth, delta r has to be also very small. Okay? If a is small and delta r suddenly go from 0.8 seconds to 1.2 seconds, then it's a large increment. In order to capture that, assuming there's an underlying function, this h0 has to be also very small to capture that. So that is giving you this a connection between a dramatic fluctuation to the value of h. So that's the kind of machinery we use to characterize in time domain how the fluctuation is in the time series. So so going through this example, we were able to see that there is such a technique which allows you to talk about fluctuation between two time series. And again, I want to go back to our initial motivation, that is, we're trying to see how EG fluctuates and how R interval fluctuates in the context of this kind of multifractal formulation. So this is a very encouraging sign that there is such a thing we can do. But turns out that this actually gave too much information, because sometimes I don't really want to know the entire domain. And there is a much more efficient an effective way to really characterize the two different time series in terms of their fluctuation strength or the singularity strength. And that is the idea of what they call the literature termed as the fractal correlation. That was initially introduced by a few applied mathematicians. J. Cole came in 2000 to prove a lot of their results. These two papers mostly demonstrate the numerical aspect of their formulation. And J. Cole shows more rigorous ground as to why it is possible to do what they call the relative multifractal. And the idea is exactly related, go back to the equivalent formulation I introduced to you earlier. That is, previously we're saying, if I can form this partition sum, I get this a partition function, and then it will behave like a power law. That exponent would allow me to figure out exactly what that singularity exponent is. And if I were to put this back in here, that means I can try to figure out exactly what kind of function I need to put in here so that this thing doesn't change too much when A is very small. And now this A is nothing but the length of an interval, and that's what we call the Lebesgue measure. In general, I can use another time series to measure how fractal this second time series to measure how fractal the first time series is. So the idea is to measure the fractal property, use a second measure to characterize this singularity. So it's all relative now. And the formulation is as follows. So this is what we had previously. I want to take this out. Somehow I reordered this animation incorrectly. Okay, this is the right one. Okay, so instead of A putting here, I'm now using another function, basically. And then I put it over here following the equivalent formulation that I introduced earlier. Then I'll be able to do something that quite similar. That is, now I'm looking at this particular scaling exponent that I can find. I will try to differentiate it to get another singularity exponent. And then I can find the corresponding f function. These are not really too critical for what we want to discuss here, but there are, basically it's a relative sort of thing. If, just imagine, it's very intuitive, if you imagine a relative motion, okay? When a particle is moving in a random fashion, if you also move in the same way, you don't find it's really random anymore. So that is really, that kind of idea can really put in here. If I have a time series fluctuate as violently as the other one, then if I were to use one to measure the other, that's almost look very, very regular. If I have a time series that fluctuate very violently, but the other one is quite smooth, and you use that the smooth one to measure the violent one, then you will be able to see a very violent fluctuation, which will then in turn be characterized by the corresponding H exponent. And this is what happened. And that this is really the most important part in our calculation. That is, if these two fractal time series have a similar characteristics in terms of how strongly they fluctuate, then this guy going to be one. It's going to be just one single exponent you can find. And it will reduce to what we call the singleton. That is, it has only one point. And that point, f of h, the f function will only take value at h equals 1 and will be 0 elsewhere. Now, in general, if they differ greatly, then you will find this become fatter and fatter. What it means is that this is the case when the two time series are very similar in terms of their fluctuations, then this whole f function just reduced to one point. If they are very different, the more different they are, the wider or the fatter this parabolic curve going to show. So that's the That's the practical aspect in our calculation that allows us to do, to try to measure just how our interval and EEG going to fluctuate and how different they are. And now, of course, there are some reasons why people are doing that. Number one is the differentiability, which is something that we realized in the very beginning of this investigation. That is, why don't we just try to compare exponents? What's wrong with that? Now, here I'm generating two different cascades. Instead of dividing the time series, the interval into two interval, for this one I divide it into three intervals at a time, and then after I divide it, the first round I do it again and again and again. Every time I divide the time interval 0 to 1, I'm going to assign those weights to each of those little interval. In the end, I multiply them all together. The other time series I generated will be dividing the time interval into five smaller ones and then continue on and so forth. Each time I assign a different weight, just the way that we sort of a toy example that allows us to assess how to build up something that could fluctuate in a very random way. And so if you were to do this and go through the wavelet transform, maximum lines, and so on, you will find that they are indistinguishable. Okay, that is, there are actually two curves over superimposed on each other. This is the red, the star correspond to the second time series. Under the red crosses are actually blue dots correspond to the first time series, and they are simply indistinguishable. So there are artificial examples you can show that very different time series could still give you very similar scaling exponents. And another characteristics about the need for doing the joint analysis, or so-called the relative multifactor analysis, is that which really just echo what we had earlier. This is going through the similar example I introduced previously for G equals 1, 0.8, 0.3, and 0 correspond to the case that there is no dependent in the fluctuation of the two time series. And if you look at the range of those H values, which is the singularity strength that characterize the fluctuation, they all lies in the same range. The only difference is about the shape of those concentric, the contour plots about the F function. So that means two time series having two very different coupling strength could still have the same scaling exponents in all cases, but they in fact have very different relationship with each other. So from this we realize H mu and H pi remain the same for all G values. So we after those two we believe that there is a need to really come up with a different sort of strategy to analyze the fractal fluctuation in different time series. So what we found at this point is that we have joint partition function analysis based on the QP parameters, and there is this relative multifractal analysis based on the idea introduced by Rady and other applied mathematicians. And if you compare the two, you realize they actually share quite similar form. This one, you just take the wavelet coefficients along the maximum line, raised to the Q power, raised to P power. This is the equivalent formulation of using one fractal time series to measure the fractal property of the other time series. And they also going to, they also have the similar construct. So a function here raised to the Q power, and another function here raised to the power minus tau sub mu of Q. So these two actually can be said to be equivalent. The way we did it is what we call the JWTMM. J stands for join a wavelet transform modulus maxima approach. So what we did is that we identified this with the pi, mu, and then the wavelet coefficient here to the pi, and then we tried to find the level set when this coefficient, I'm sorry, this exponent tau QP equal to zero. So you can imagine tau QP is a two-parameter scalar function. It basically, if you plot it on a two-dimensional plane, it gives you a surface. And I look at that surface and find a set of QP where the tau exponent equal to zero. Once it's equal to zero, the right-hand side for this entire joint partition function no longer depends on the A or the scale, and that's exactly the tau function I'm looking for. So I'm going to find just the set of QP belong to this level set. Once I find it, I would be able to find this tau y slash x, which is equivalent to the f function that we introduced earlier for this relative multifractal analysis. So that's our algorithm. These are just to repeat what we discussed above, put it in a more formal language. There are other things you can talk about this approach. In fact, there is a factorization, almost follow exactly the idea of doing algebraic factorization. So we essentially what we do is that we look at how two time series fluctuate as if they are jointly fluctuating to each other, and we try to factorize the one that they couple to each other, or they show the similar characteristic to each other. Okay, so the algorithm for us to analyze the heart rate and brain data fluctuation would be given x and y. X could be our interval, y would be the EEG. The first thing we did was we do the wavelet transform for each of the time series, and then we form this partition function. This partition function will be formed based on the maximal lines, and then we try to estimate the tau QP. That part can be quite reliably done. Afterwards, once we figure out what tau QP is, we're going to locate the level set when tau QP equal to zero. Once that is found, we have this particular relationship between those Q and P values that lies in this level set, and they're going to describe this relationship. Once this is found, we will be able to go through this calculation. Eventually, this is our goal. We're trying to find this particular F function. As I said earlier, if this F function reduced to just one point, that means the two-time series is the fluctuation two-time series has some sort of synchrony. Whenever this time series has a spike, the other one will also show a spike. But once they get really fatter and fatter, that means the fluctuation in two-time series is almost uncorrelated to each other. So that is exactly the line of logic that we apply to try to tackle our problem. And so we go to the experiments. What we did was we recruited 11 young adults, eight males, three females, and we applied the protocol of head up tilt. Basically, we have the subject come in at the same time of 2 days, and we collect 40 minutes in the supine test, and then about 40 plus some minutes, depending on how tolerant the subject is. After some time, they feel dizzy and they have to get off the tilt table. We oriented to 70 degrees because from literature, this is the angle where some significant change in the EEG power has been reported. So our data acquisition was an ambulatory recorder, and these are the settings for the recording. Once we collect the R interval, the ECG and EEG, we then go through, extract the R intervals, eliminate skip beats or other artifacts, and then we do the joint WTMN. We also conduct the principal component analysis. That is, we eventually estimate some of the spectral property of the time series, so we have a chance to go back to some of the physiological interpretation for the of the time series. So this is the sort of a flow chart of what we were doing. We have collected those R interval, I call it R sub n and E of t, the EEG. And then what we did was, because our interval is on the B2B basis, EEG is a continuous time series. So what we did was we aggregate the EEG based on every heartbeat. So we collect all the EEG data within each heartbeat, and then we find the average value of the EEG. Once we finished this calculation, we have the Y sequence. So every heartbeat here will have a value AEEG here. Once we have these two time series, we will do their WTMM or the wavelet transform, and we get all the coefficient we need. We just put them back into this joint partition function. Once we find it, we find the tau QP, we figure out what the level set is, and then we will extract the relationship between Q and P in that level set. Eventually, that's what we're trying to find. At the same time, we also look at the R interval to find its multifactorial spectrum, see if there's any relationship between the two. And we also conduct a spectral analysis based on the time series. We try to do the power spectral density to extract the low frequency, high frequency from the R interval. And for the EEG, we examine the theta, alpha, beta bands power. So we were hoping the relative multifactorial characteristic we extracted can somehow be correlated with some of these spectral measures. So we have some physiological interpretation to it. And the variable of interest in our analysis consists of the width of those multifactorial spectrum. This is the multifactorial spectrum of the R interval. This is the multifactorial spectrum of the relative RR versus EEG fluctuations. We also have five different variables corresponding to the low frequency power, high frequency power of the R interval, theta, alpha, beta bands power. So in total, we're looking at a variable array of six elements. To figure out their relationship, we're hoping to find some connection between this five to the width of the F H of R slash Y, because the width of this really characterizes how much coupling there is between the RRN and the EEG. So in doing so, we do the principal component analysis. For every subject, we construct this vector. So we have 11 subjects. We're going to basically build this little array of 11 times 6. So each row characterizes various measures about their physiological response from the head-up tilt. And they're going to fill up some region in the six-dimensional space that is given by the width of the relative multifractal measure and all the other spectral measures from the R interval and EEG. The idea of principal component analysis is to simply reorient this according to the variation or the variance that is exhibited in the data to find the optimal set of corner system. So once this is carried out, we're going to obtain new sets of corner system, consists of linear combination of the old set, which is this six variables. We use two numbers to give us some guide as to how to read those results. One is the principal value associated with each of those new axes that obtained from the principal component analysis, and also the variance capture, which eventually you can imagine that's like an energy capture in the system. We make a cutoff at certain K value above which we don't consider there's any significant change. So this is the results. This is the R interval in supine. And this is the same subject once it come in to take the R interval in the upright position. And you have the expected characteristics. In the supine, you have large fluctuation, and the R interval lies in a much higher level compared to the upright position, and the fluctuation become more tame, and the corresponding EEG time series. These are the F, or the multifactorial spectrum for the RR interval and the AEEG sequence. So this is the supine in the blue dots, upright in the red crosses. This is for the RR intervals, and this is for the aggregated EEG time series. So they all show some fractal characteristics. And then the question we're trying to answer is, how do we relate these two together? Now, just before we show the results, I also want to show you about some of the spectral calculation. We do a moving window to try to find the so-called sympathovagal index that characterizes how much sympathetic and parasympathetic activity compared to the parasympathetic. That is given by the low frequency power divided by the high frequency power. One is in the upright position, you find that it's going through, it's attained a much bigger value compared to the supine. That just indicates there's activation of the sympathetic system and perhaps a withdrawal of the parasympathetic system. And there are also, using moving window, the alpha, theta, alpha, beta band character, power calculation over the time axis. From this, it doesn't really show too much any recognizable features that you can say right there. So we take this time series, given some of those multifactor characteristics, we go through the calculation, and this is the supine maximum lines in the supine data circle and the EEG, AEG in the cross. So these are the maximum lines here, and this is the upright. And this is the partition function, the joint partition function, from which you can see the power law characteristics can be quickly verified just by this log-log plot. So going through a range of Q and P, we estimate all the corresponding slope, which then give us the tau QP. Once we have the tau QP, we have the surface here. This is the the spline surface fit based on the value tau QP we obtain. And the blue line here represents the L0, which corresponds to the set of QP value where tau QP equals zero. This is for the supine case, this is for the upright case. Given this, and I replotted this by looking down from the to the plane, and you have the Q. This is actually the P, but I reinterpreted it to be the relative multifractal tau r slash y. So based on this curve, I find its local slope and then eventually calculate the relative multifractal spectrum. This is for the supine case, this is for the upright case. So our analysis really relies on reading the widths of those spectrum. First of all, for the R interval, when the widths become very wide, when you have a very large width, which means this is a very fat f of h function, that means you need a lot of scaling exponents to characterize this fluctuation. Typically, that's what we call it, very complex. Okay, so the more complex the time series is, the more, the bigger, fatter this f function gonna get. Now, for this, the interpretation is a bit different. As we noted earlier using those artificial examples, the more coupled the two time series is, you're going to find this F getting narrower and narrower. So the wider the width of this relative multifactorial spectrum, the larger the difference is the singularity. If the widths become very small, that means the fluctuation of the underlying time series are very, very similar. So this is we rely on these two parameters to give us the final read about what happened here. We compare the supine and upright. So if this parameter is bigger than one, that means RI and EEG exhibit less fractal correlation. Because if this is bigger than one, that means the power, the relative multifactorial spectrum is very wide in the supine compared to the in the upright compared to the supine. So that means simply means you have they sort of fluctuate in their own way once you go from supine to the upright. So we look at this this parameter to understand what kind of change there is in terms of the coupling between EEG and RR, RR interval. And also we do something similar for just for the RR interval time series. We look at the changes between upright and supine. If this is bigger than one, that means you have a much wider multifactorial spectrum for the RR interval in the upright position compared to supine. That means the fluctuation is more complex in the upright position compared to the supine position. And the experimental results show this. So our URY and UR plotted as the X and Y. There are 11 dots here. They seem to lie along this anti-correlated sort of fashion way. Less correlated situation happens when the R interval is less complex, and then you have more complex R fluctuation associated with more fractal correlation. Now, remember, these U parameters really characterize the change. Okay, so what this group of subject compared to this group of subject, all of them really is saying that the more complex the R interval gets in terms of its fluctuation, the more coupling or the more connection between the fluctuation in R intervals and EEG fluctuations. I want to show you also the principal component analysis so that we can sort of capture what kind of underlying power spectral measures that we can relate to this result. So we use those six variables as parameters, and then we go through the PCA. We get the new axis, and then we have the principal value and the variance captures. So from the sum, this variance capture, we see that about using three axes, that will be enough to capture most of the variation in the data. And this is what we find. This is the supine, this is the upright. From the first tick mark to the sixth, they are the widths of the relative multifractal spectrum, lower frequency, higher frequency of HRV, theta, alpha, beta. And it is the first three that we're looking at. And in particular, we only want to focusing on the ones that has a large first coefficients, because it corresponds to the relative multifractal width between the R interval and EEG. So we look at the first and the third one, you realize the dominant variables that contribute to this particular principal axis consist of the, in addition to low and high frequency of the HRV, you see it also involves alpha and beta band, which is here and here. Theta always appears to be the least significant in those new axes defined from the PCA. For the upright, we only read for the first one because the remaining two doesn't seem to have a large W, the width reading. So we only read the first one, even though this is much smaller compared to this bar, but still, relatively speaking, compared to all the power spectrum, power spectral measures, it is still the alpha and beta band characteristic seems to show up to couple with the relative multifractal characteristics. Our concluding remarks is that there is similar fractal characteristics in the brain and heart rate data. We call it central autonomic fractal correlation. In particular, the data shows the change towards stronger fractal correlation implies the change towards more complex HRV multifractal characteristics. And also going through this principal component analysis, we don't find a unique EEG power measures that can't stand out. It seems that it is the alpha beta together that's contributing to this, we call it the CAFC. in the original topic I submitted to the workshop was there is actually arousal picture that we're trying to build. Unfortunately, I'm not able to get something statistically significant. So, but I want to throw the idea just in case there is something that people could follow through. And there are some indications. There may be some arousal factor in terms of how the central nervous system and HRV, specifically in the context of multifractal characteristics, this arousal factor is in play. I just want to point out a few study in the literature. The first one is 1989 by R.J. Cole, who studied the, again, head up tilt, how the EEG changes. In the upright position, he noticed there's an increase in beta band power, and he suggests there is some EEG arousal once the person is in the upright position. And later, Schneider, they study the parabolic flight. That is, astronaut, they try to experience weightless situation. And there's a lot of interest of doing so because astronauts come back down from International Space Station, they get fainted very easily, and they are always very weak. And there are lots of study regarding what kind of cardiovascular changes happens up there without the gravity. So this is just one attempt to trying to address the issues, and he found that during the parabolic flight, there's a significant decrease of the beta and alpha band power, but his study really based on a very short span, in this case 16 seconds. Lipnicki came out in the end to try to suggest the kind of mechanism that could contribute to what Schneider observed, and that that is again related to, he suggested related to the barrel reflex. That is, when barrel reflex is stimulated, you're going to have cortical inhibition, which then leads to the reduction of those band power. In our case, we try to get some idea whether the beta band could stand out specifically in our results. What we did was we tried to correlate this two using just the standard two variable correlation. We find that for the beta band, it is significant. Significant in terms of how this set of data correlate with the width of the multifractal relative multifractal spectrum. But if you look at the variation along the subject, we do not see consistent increase in the beta band. This is plotted as the power of the beta band characteristics for the subject, and the open circle is supine, red is upright. Some subjects show increase in the beta band activity using the traditional interpretation that would mean arousal, but not all of them. So that's what we why we could not really claim at this point. We believe one of the reasons is we conducted 40 minutes upright, so the subject was initially quite alert perhaps, but over time fatigue, other factors set in, they become less vigilant, and then this beta characteristics just fade away. So our conclusion is there is a fractal characteristic that can be extracted, and we believe there are more work to be done, in particular perhaps more carefully designed experiment that would allow you to address the arousal level of the response. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to questions.
Often the increase in the beta power. So that will be interesting in the future to see that. the fine tuning of what exactly was in the EEG to make that correlation. But definitely the move in the future is the integration of multiple systems, and not focusing.